Margaret B. Blackman, Copying People, Northwest Coast Native Response to Early Photography. Read for BC Studies, number 52, Winter, 1981-82. The Past in Focus, Photography in British Columbia, 1858-1914. Photographs owe their existence to a loose cooperation, quasi-magical, quasi-accidental, between photographer and subject, mediated by an ever simpler and more automated machine, which even when capricious, can produce a result that is interesting and never entirely wrong. The portrait, reflecting a multifaceted human being, must be realized in a moment, and once realized, remains fixed and unchangeable. The problem becomes more complex when the photographer's aim and the sitter's desire go beyond recording facial features to a more penetrating portrait of the individual. Regardless of how else it might be viewed, an historical photograph must be recognized as the outcome of an interaction between photographer and subject matter. When the subject of the image is human, the interaction is, of course, all the richer and more complex. There exists a large visual archive of such historical interactions between early photographers and British Columbia Native Indians. Historians and anthropologists are aware that such images are capable of providing a wealth of ethnological and cultural historical data, but to fully understand them, one must know not only what the photographers bring to the act of creating images, but also the ideas natives hold about the images, their creation, and their functions. Although photographers have not always been explicit about what they do or why they do it, the documentation of their work is far richer than the record of native response to their activities. The cultural milieu of Victorian image-making, the photographers, the subjects of their cameras, the audiences to whom the images speak, has been the focus of a number of publications. But the responses of natives to the camera and the evolution of their conceptions of photographic images are virtually unknown and unexplored. Focusing primarily upon the Haida of British Columbia and southeastern Alaska, this paper is offered as an initial inquiry into the perceptions of and reactions to photography by Northwest Coast natives during the latter 19th and early 20th centuries. How natives viewed the photography process and the expectations they held of imaging must be pursued largely through the documented history of native photographer contact, a history in which the native seldom speaks for himself. Though the images of natives are revealing by themselves, native reaction to photographers and photographs is read primarily through the words of outsiders who witness the act of creating images of native people, most often the photographers. Unfortunately, even this documentation is sparse, and the present study provokes more questions than it answers. Nevertheless, it is hoped that this effort will lead to further exploration of a little-known but critical domain to the understanding of historical images of native peoples. 19th Century Images of Northwest Coast Natives. The Context. In the photographer's studio, native Northwest Coast people were photographed in the cultural settings of those who made their images. They were also photographed in their own cultural settings by photographers who traveled to their villages. Later, just after the turn of the 20th century, natives, as consumers of photographic images, were photographed in contexts of their own choosing, albeit ones that often reflected Euro-American notions of image content. Some of the earliest photographs of Northwest Coast natives were made in Victoria studios. Frederick Daly, Charles Gentile, and Hannah Maynard, and possibly her husband Richard, photographed Northwest Coast Indians in their studios in the 1860s and 1870s. The images they made were carte de visite, 2 1/4 inches by 3 3/4 inches head and shoulders or full-length poses. As the term carte de visite suggests, Victorians used the little self-portraits as calling cards. They also avidly collected carte de visite portraits of others, family, friends, celebrities, and displayed them in specially made albums. Popular between 1860 and about 1875, cartes de visite were mass-produced and for a while rivaled in sales the popular card stereograph views. Cartes de visite of celebrities were especially popular and brought lucrative returns to photographic studios. For example, according to one source, 100,000 cartes de visite of Abraham Lincoln were produced and distributed during the 1860 presidential campaign, and 70,000 cartes de visite of the Prince Consort were marketed in England the week following his death. I suspect that the cartes de visite of BC natives were similarly made to be marketed to white collectors of images, and were little used or collected by natives. That Northwest Coast natives did not generally enter photography studios with the intent of commissioning self-images is suggested in the following newspaper account of a Songhees chief's visit to the studio of Charles Gentile in 1864. Gentile made carte de visite portraits of the chief and his wife. His Majesty King Freezy I and his royal spouse, the Queen of Songhish, visited the city yesterday and honored Mr. Gentile, photographic artist of Fort Street, by sitting for their portraits. Their Majesties appeared to be highly delighted with their counterparts, although in neither case could the words of the poet be applied with justice. Love and beauty still visage grace. Before taking his departure, the wily but uxorious old king requested the artist to potlatch his better half 4 bits, which was immediately done, and the chikimen, or coins, having been safely ensconced in the folds of the royal robes, 3-point blankets, their majesties stalked off with a dignity becoming their exalted station. The British Colonist, 1864. It is also unlikely that a native like Haida Mary, described as Mrs. Maynard's washerwoman, ordered the carte de visite photograph of herself shown in Plate 1, particularly when a similar studio image of her was subsequently re-photographed against the backdrop of the abandoned Haida village of Kayang, taken from a photo by Richard Maynard, and marketed. This combined pair of images is interesting because it suggests that for the photographer, good images of native people in properly native settings could be created by combining 2 very different types of photographs into a single image. The Maynards seem to prefer Haida backdrops for their Indian subjects, regardless of the individual's tribe. In one example from the files of the BC Provincial Museum, a group of Kwakutl women are shown against the background of the Haida village of Kayang. Richard and Hannah Maynard were not unique in their practice of creating images of native BC Indians. Many years later, B.W. Leeson, a photographer from Kwatsino, constructed a Kwakutl potlatch by cutting and pasting individuals from several different photographs onto the background of a Kwakutl house interior. The photography studios of Victoria provided many natives their initial encounter with the camera. Did curiosity bring them there? Or were they openly solicited by photographers with promise of remuneration? I've found no historical description of natives' initial reactions to the studios, their operators, and machinery. It is evident that by the mid to late 1860s, however, natives in Victoria were not only familiar with the portrait galleries, but some, like the Songhees chief Freezy, carried considerable presence into the image-making process. From early exposure to the camera in Victoria studios, Northwest Coast natives may have come to regard photography as portraiture. The Chinook jargon term for photograph, which translates as face picture, certainly suggests so. I suspect, too, that this term was widely used by Victoria photographers to communicate with natives whose images they marketed. The camera, transplanted from the white man's studio to native cultural settings, probably caused greater stir among natives there than in Victoria. Among the West Coast people and the Hagwelgut carrier, for example, curiosity and fright, respectively, were noted as initial responses to the camera. Victoria photographer Frederick Daly, at Ahosat in 1866, prepared to photograph the village, but when I put my head under the focusing cloth of the camera, to my surprise on withdrawing it, I found myself surrounded by about 20 of the natives squatting on the ground, watching my movements. Perhaps it was Daly who was frightened, for he packed up his camera as quickly as possible, distributed tobacco to the natives, and headed for his dinghy. Charles Horetsky, traveling in northern BC in 1872, explained why an Indian he had hired to carry his camera became frightened of the dreaded box and took off. A few months previous, the gentleman in charge of the mission station at the mouth of the Nas River had paid a pastoral visit to the Aquilget or Haglugett Indians. With his other impedimenta, he had brought a small magic lantern and slides, which were duly exhibited to their wondering gaze, not without a certain amount of pomp and ceremony. After the reverend gentleman's departure, however, it most unfortunately happened that a species of cholera broke out among the native Heseltonians, the origin of which they most illogically attributed to the one-eyed devil in the lantern and its exhibitor. I was not unnaturally a little shy of parading the camera, an instrument bearing a certain family likeness to the hated lantern. Horetsky, 1874. Horetsky's camera-bearer became sick, and according to Charlie, the Haida cook left evidently in mortal terror of the box and its mysterious contents. Interestingly, Horetsky adds, Charlie, being a hider and above such superstitious fears, shouldered the box without comment. Was Charlie above such superstitions because he was used to dealing with white people, or did he shoulder the box without comment because that was the Haida way of confronting fear? Horetsky doesn't elaborate. Haida, like Charlie the cook and Mary the washerwoman, were familiar with photography several years before the earliest recorded encounter of the Haida with a photographer in their own territory. This historic interaction took place on 2nd of July, 1875, and is noted by James G. Swan, who was present on the occasion. Swan had come to southeastern Alaska on the U.S. revenue cutter Walcott to collect ethnographic materials for the Smithsonian. While the Walcott was docked at Klingquan Village, Ginuan, a high-ranking chief and silver carver, with his wife and four children and a number of Indians, came on board and their pictures were photographed by Mr. Broadbent, who was evidently the official ship's photographer. Swan's mention of the event is very matter-of-fact, and in the absence of data to the contrary, one can assume that the Klingquang natives were neither reluctant nor fearful of being photographed. In fact, one might even read in Swan's statement a certain willingness to pose for the photographer. Unfortunately, these early photographs have not been located in any archives, and my attempts to find them have been unsuccessful. Only Swan's terse statement documents this historic encounter. 3 years later, the Queen Charlotte Haida encountered George M. Dawson, geologist, geographer, amateur ethnographer, and the first, as far as we know, white man to photograph Haida people and villages on the Queen Charlotte Islands. Dawson found the Haida in 1878 very different from Ginuan and his group. At Langara Island on August 23rd, just prior to a big potlatch, he recorded in his journal, took photo of two chiefs, Albert Edenshaw and Wea, and of as many of the rest of the people as would come. Most, however, disliked the idea, and especially the women, not one of whom appeared. Was this the first time these Haida had seen a camera? Did Dawson explain what he was about to do? Did the people have an opportunity to see any of his images? And what in particular did they find frightening? We do not know the answers to these questions. Nor, unfortunately, do we know the identity of the men and boys in the group shot that Dawson made, with the exception of Wea and Edenshaw. Were they, like the latter two chiefs, high-ranking individuals who stepped boldly forward to face Dawson's strange machinery? Did Dawson encourage them with offers of payment for their posing? I rather doubt it, for he does not mention offering payment or native requests for it. The conservatism of the Haida women in 1878 is interesting, for women appear in photographs made on the Queen Charlotte's the following year, and routinely after that. In the years prior to the turn of the 20th century, several photographers came to the Queen Charlotte Islands to record Haida villages and their people. Of particular significance are the photographic records of O.C. Hastings, Edward Dossiter, Richard Maynard, Robert Reeford, and E.P. Allen. The summer following Dawson's visit, O.C. Hastings arrived on the Queen Charlotte Islands as official photographer for Indian Commissioner Israel W. Powell's inspection tour of native coastal villages. Although Hastings took 7 photographs at Masset, neither he nor his photography is mentioned in Powell's report. Of the Haida response to Hastings' camera, we know only that they were more amenable to being photographed than the year before. People are the focus of 2 Hastings photographs, and both include Haida women. On a second inspection tour, which took him to the Queen Charlotte Islands 2 years later, Israel Powell took Victoria photographer Edward Dossiter with him. Dossiter photographed a number of Haida people in the summer of 1881. At Skidegat, two men, a half-breed woman, at Yan, a group of women and children, and two separate photographs of old women. At Masset, an old woman, an elaborately tattooed man, and four Haida chiefs posed in costume beside a house, one of whom is the tattooed man photographed separately. Once again, Powell's report does not mention the photographer or the images he made, so we do not know if the Haida posed willingly for Dossiter's camera, or if they were enticed by promise of payment. It is significant, however, that none of the old Haida women looked at Dossiter when he took their pictures, while the four chiefs of Masset and others directly faced his camera. Dossiter's image of the four chiefs merits mention, for they are garbed in the apparel of the Saiga, the possessed, or shamans, that collectivity of dancers who performed in the winter dance ceremony. Perhaps they had performed a welcome dance for Powell's party, following which their photos were made. It is more likely, however, since two are masked, and masks were not worn in welcome dance performances, that these individuals had dressed in the ceremonial paraphernalia to which their rank entitled them, in order that Dossiter might photograph them. The elaborately tattooed man on the far right, Sklau, was not only photographed individually by Dossiter, but posed for E.P. Allen in 1897 by dint of much persuasion and a piece of silver. Did Sklau have to be similarly persuaded 16 years earlier to pose for Dossiter? Aside from the images themselves, we know nothing of the context of Dossiter's photographs. The three photographs of Sklau exemplify a pattern in early photography of the Haida. Certain individuals appear more than once and in images made by different photographers. Chief Edenshaw, for example, was photographed by Dawson in 1878, by Robert Reeford in 1890, and by Masset missionary J. H. Keene in 1893. Chief Wea appears twice, in Dawson's 1878 image taken at Langara Island, and the following year in a Hastings photograph. Dr. Quood, a lineage chief and Masset shaman of renown, appears with the three other chiefs in Dossiter's photograph, and again in Reeford's photograph, standing behind Edenshaw. Quood also appears in the background of a photograph taken sometime between 1884 and 1888, and attributed to Maynard from the latter year. Kayingasa, identified as a Haida chieftainess by Masset missionary Charles Harrison, is one of three Haida basket makers photographed by Hastings in front of Wea's house and appears in a stereo photo made by Richard Maynard 5 years later. All of these individuals were of high rank. Kayingasa, in particular, was imposing, for Harrison writes, "I once knew an old Haida chieftess named Kayingasa who could in appearance have shamed Macbeth's witches. Her photograph was taken by the late Mr. Maynard about 30 years ago, and it is being sold at the present day in Victoria and labeled Princess Kayingasa of Masset. Whenever she happened to be passing any house, she was always importuned to enter and make herself at home. When she did condescend to enter, there was always special decorum for the occasion. Even the children hushed their play, and dignified quiet took the place of loud ejaculations and laughter." Were the high-ranking more amenable to submitting to the novelty of image-making, or was it the visual markers of high status, tattoos, librettes, that attracted photographers to them, or were both factors involved? By the time Richard Maynard made the first of two trips to the Queen Charlotte Islands in the spring of 1884, the Haida had been exposed to and photographed by several photographers. Furthermore, there are indications that visual images had become implanted in Haida culture, a fact which Maynard's own photographs document. The photographs which he made of Haida house interiors show newspaper pictorials displayed on the back walls of the house. One utilitarian function of these pictorials is noted by James Swan, who, the preceding year, commented upon those displayed in Charles Edenshaw's house. From these pictorials, Charlie gets many of the designs he carves on wood or stone or ivory. There is some suggestion that the Haida had been introduced to another kind of visual image in the early 1880s. In June 1883, Massett missionary Charles Harrison requested of the Anglican Church Missionary Society in London magic lantern slides. Lantern slides were widely used by mission groups to visually reinforce the message of Christianity, and the Church Missionary Society probably willingly supplied its employees with the equipment. Unfortunately, there is no more mention of lantern slides in any of the late 19th century missionary correspondence or publications of Massett missionaries. Maynard photographed only a few people during his stay on the Queen Charlotte's. At Massett, for example, he made a stereo of Kayingasa, as noted above. He included two men in his stereo photograph of the interior of Anakdas, house shown in Plate 6. And finally, he made a photo of a group Klutschman. This last photograph, mentioned in Maynard's diary, has unfortunately not survived in any archives. The problem of remuneration doubtless affected Maynard's eagerness and ability to photograph natives. In the one instance he recorded, Maynard noted that the Massett Hudson's Bay Company factor wanted photographs of two short totem poles with a native in the center for scale. The native, requesting pay, refused the offer of a Hudson's Bay blanket, and an irritated Maynard wrote, "So we find some other things around," and got the photo. No photographs of Massett Haida people have been located from Maynard's second trip to the Queen Charlotte's in 1888. Robert Reeford, scion of a shipping magnate from Montreal, came to the northern Queen Charlotte Islands in the fall of 1890 and took some 22 photographs with two cameras, one of which was George Eastman's new Kodak No. 2. Reeford appeared in Massett at a time when many people were likely to have been present, late October, and the content of his photographs suggests that he and his cameras were the subject of much attention, interest, and discussion. Reeford's images include several with people, in groups and individually. The most revealing of his photographs are three which portray native response to camera and photographer. In one Kodak snapshot, an old woman has turned quickly to look at the camera. Her mouth is open in mid-sentence, and she appears to be speaking to the photographer. Entitled by Reeford, "Lady Using Bad Language," one needn't speculate long on her reaction to the camera. In another Kodak snapshot, a woman has turned her back to the camera just as the photographer attempted to take her picture. The juxtaposition of his subject and Reeford's other camera in the image suggests that the lady might have been looking through the ground glass back of the camera before turning away to avoid having her photograph taken. Perhaps Reeford, his traveling companions, and the two cameras which he set up at various locations along the village frontage were too much of an intrusion. Reeford was, after all, one of the very few photographers to appear in a Haida village at a time when many people were resident. Most photographers came during the summer months, when numbers of people were away fishing or engaged in other subsistence pursuits. The third noteworthy Reeford photograph, entitled by the photographer "Town Council Taking It In," shows a cluster of men and little boys, but no women, around one of Reeford's cameras. He, with his Kodak, has photographed them. Three peer through the ground glass back underneath the black cloth while others wait their turn for a look. Franz Boas' comment on the Fort Rupert Quacutal of 1894 applies equally to the Haida. "The people," he said, "are curious to see the pictures from the back of the camera." Did the Haida find the view and the technology as baffling as a Fort Rupert Quacutal who, upon looking through Boaz's camera at a woman the latter was about to photograph, noticed that the picture, or ground glass image, was upside down, and ran away telling everybody that her clothes had fallen over her head? By the time J.H. Keene, missionary at Massett, took two or three portraits of characteristic Haida in 1893, the Massett people were becoming accustomed to the presence of a camera. Keene was the only one of the missionaries to use a camera, and as late as 1970-71, several elderly Haida remembered having seen the cleric taking photographs in the village. Haida portraiture for different purposes was also undertaken in 1897 by photographer E.P. Allen from the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago. Allen accompanied George Dorsey on an excursion of Haida and Tlingit villages, and while at Masset, took for Dorsey at least 5 head and shoulders portraits of Haida men and women. In the same year, Franz Boas made portraits of Haida at Port Essington. Though their portrait photographs were similar and motivated by interest in racial types, Boas and Dorsey disagreed vehemently on the meaning of racial differences. How the Haida felt about having their heads measured and then subjected to the scrutiny of the camera lens was not recorded. As noted earlier, in addition to these anthropometric photographs, Allen persuaded Sklau to pose so that Dorsey might carry away the photograph of his totem, which was tattooed on his breast. The remaining Allen photographs of Haida people include a basket maker posed beside Chief Wea's house, a group of people on the front steps of a home, an old man sitting on the beach, and a group of people processing cedar bark. I suspect that Allen had to pay at least those individuals who posed for anthropometric photographs, though Sklau is the only subject given specific mention in Dorsey's account. Although they were well accustomed to cameras and photographers by 1915, one wonders what the Haida must have thought when Edward S. Curtis appeared in their midst to reconstruct their images as they might have appeared 100, even 200 years before. I suspect that progressive leader Alfred Adams, for one, was amused at having to cover his short haircut with Curtis's wig. By the time of Curtis's visit, professional photographers no longer journeyed to the Queen Charlotte Islands to record Haida villages. The houses were conventional white man's style cottages, the people dressed in European-style clothing, and the majority of totem poles had been cut down. The camera had been accepted in Haida culture, but professional photographers found little saleable material to record in Haida villages. From photo curios to photographic images for native use. I wonder if the Haida, in naming the camera Klega Ninjangwe, copying people, didn't see in it and its images the same mimetic arts that we do. The Haida equated camera with mask, which they also called Ninjangyu, copying. Although cameras of visiting photographers recorded far more architectural than human forms, the magical qualities of the instrument were evidently most vividly expressed in its ability to replicate the human form. Portrait masks, with their humanoid faces, were most like the photograph, for they too copied people. Although some portrait masks are quite stylized, the Haida artist's ability to render realistic copies of individuals was acknowledged. 2 Haida portrait masks, shown in J.C.H. King's book, for example, are remarked upon by their collectors as exact likenesses of the women they portray. Native artists could render carved wood replicas of spirits, ancestors, and even living individuals. The photographer, with his mysterious machinery, could also do the latter. Given the importance of masks and other visual forms created by the artist, the sudden appearance of an exotic visual medium which reproduced the human form surely had a significant impact upon the Haida. The camera not only produced two-dimensional copies, but on its ground glass back, copies of people appeared, moved about, and then disappeared, not unlike the masked dancer. I wonder, too, if by the 1880s and 1890s, the equation of photograph and mask didn't have yet another and perhaps ironic meaning for the Haida. For many whites who took them, and probably for many natives as well, photographs of natives were curios, collected like the masks, baskets, and boxes sold to curio hunters and displayed like museum artifacts. Long years of trading experience with Euro-Americans taught the Haida to drive sharp bargains, so it is not surprising that during an era of intensive curio collecting, they would part with both their artifacts and their images for a price. Photographers, like curio hunters, sought the old, the traditional. B.W. Leeson, for example, lamented the Kwakutl who wanted to dress like white people for his cameras. And, for successful images, photographers of the Haida turned to old Haida women wearing librettes. As human curios, the Haida are missing part of their identity. Although women posed for Hastings, Dossiter, and Allen as basket makers, there is some doubt that all three women who sat for Hastings were basket makers, and four men presented themselves as chiefs, there is little in the remaining photographs which gives the viewer a sense of who these people really were. Posed individually by totem poles or as a group for a great house, the people are stiff, out of context even, not unlike curios and artifacts on museum display shelves. One old woman with a librette is substitutable for any other. However, when the Haida began to use images of themselves for their own purposes, the image content changed. One has only to study the photograph of Chief Sonehat of New Kassan, Alaska, to understand what was important to him in his presentation of self to the camera. His badge, his Western-style clothing, his Chilkat dancing blanket, and his speaker's staff. After the turn of the 20th century, the family photo album had become established among the Haida, as had the native photographer. Now the Haida recorded many of the same things families elsewhere recorded in photo album images. Formal portraits in Sunday dress, a bride and groom and their wedding party. Family photos also document funerals. The casket, the deceased, the funeral procession, the family posed beside the tombstone. Though funeral photographs and even funeral albums were common in Victorian culture, their appearance among the Haida likely relates to the traditional importance of mortuary rituals in native culture. Although the content of the later images shown here was controlled by the Haida, the images were made by outsiders. Unfortunately, I have seen few images of Haida people and places made by Haida photographers. Masset Haida elders recalled a villager named Jinau, William Harding, who had a camera with a black cloth and a tripod. Jinau was the most active of several amateur Haida photographers, all men, who took photographs after about 1910. In a sense, Jinau was the village photographer, recording weddings, funerals, and family portraits. I wonder, though, if he wasn't as much fascinated by the ground glass image as by the final product, for I was told that he often purposely took photographs of family groups without any film in the camera, reporting later that his images had not turned out. Perhaps, like the masked dance performances, it was the ritual of copying people that was ultimately important and enjoyable in the early years of Haida photography. During the last 25 years of the 19th century, the Haida witnessed the making of well over 1,000 images of their houses, totem poles, and people. Though they may have actually seen very few of the final products, they understood the camera as an effective imitator of human behavior. I have argued, too, that they saw the photographers who carried off their images much as the collectors who carried off their material past. They parted with their images as they parted with their totem poles and masks, for a price. Eventually, photographic imaging became part of Haida culture, and they turned it to their own purposes, recording themselves as they wished to be seen. The earlier photographs, the curio images, record the archival Indian. They render the form, but not the self. It is the later images, the Haida images, which truly copy people.